Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 41 through 45 of Part 3. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
Let's get started by talking about the new blog posts we have coming out this weekend.
Oh, yes. I am so excited for this blog post.
I knew you would be.
I know. It's one of my favorite topics. It's by Dr. Beatrice Groves, and it is a lengthy exploration of all the connections between Jane Austen's work and the Strike novels, which I have been hoping for Austen epigraphs for a very long time. But this blog post is almost as good. It goes really deep into Persuasion and Mansfield Park, which I think are two of the less appreciated novels, but they both really deserve it. And then Emma, of course, absolute classic. So yeah, it's really good. Definitely go check it out.
I mean, we all know I haven't read Jane Austen, but I read this post and I really enjoyed it. It's very shippy, which...
deeply shippy.
Obviously, I love. Very good. I really, really enjoyed the talk about the sea. Great connections with the sea.
Very much so.
So yeah, that'll be out on the 28th.
Awesome.
And thank you so much to her for letting us post this one because we really liked it.
Yes.
Speaking of thank yous, I think that before we move on to our next subject, that we should give a shout out to the people who have donated to our Ko-fi.
Yes.
People who have been so, so, so generous. And I'm blown away.
Yeah.
Completely mind blown. Yes.
Anytime we get an email, it's just like, oh, wow.
It's really, really, really kind and really helps us out with the costs of the podcast.
It really does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Should we jump into our Q&A?
Yes.
I had a lot of fun with this one.
I could tell.
By the essay that I wrote in response to it.
Yeah, the small novel.
Yeah.
So the Q&A for this episode is, for a change, Strike finds himself mostly romantically unattached in The Running Grave. Does this change the level of commitment he shows to his investigative work?
Well, Strike, as we know, has pretty much been through a different woman in every book, other than book 5, Troubled Blood, where he didn't have any dalliances. That book was really dominated by another woman, his aunt Joan, who was dying. He's not completely celibate in this book, that's for sure. He has what I would say is probably the most reckless and stupid liaison he's had in a long time. But there you go. I don't think it's so much that he's wanting to concentrate on his investigative work, because he's always put that first in any case, and women in his life have indeed complained about that. It's more that he is becoming aware that the woman he really wants is not one of the people he keeps having flings with. You know, that's really what's taken the place of long-term dalliances. I think he's now at the point where he's thinking all or nothing. Almost. He's sort of getting there.
This answer really got me thinking about something that has been in the back of my mind for a long time, but I've never really examined it because I felt like I didn't know enough about it to come to any real conclusions. But when she talks about Strike having a different love interest in each book, it brought this question up for me because besides Strike, I do like detective fiction and mysteries. And I feel like the books I've read in the past have also had a very similar thing where the detective will have a bunch of different love interests across the series. Never settle down, that kind of thing. I definitely feel like I remember this with Alex Cross, although don't quote me on that because it's been over a decade since I've read anything by James Patterson. But I just feel like it's possible that this is a detective-y noir thing. And I'm wondering if this is part of what J.K. Rowling is doing, where she takes these tropes and is changing them as Strike grows and heals, like with smoking, you know? Strike dating different women in each book is a thing that some people have complained about, and I've seen that. And in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, but that's a detective thing. That's just normal. But again, I didn't feel like I knew enough to make the argument. So I asked Kurt about this, because he's the one who really kicked off this idea for me of J.K. Rowling's take on detective noir. And here's what he said. To my knowledge, which is not very extensive, I'd say that the traditional male detective is a loner and that the promise of real love always evades him. whether it's Irene Adler for Sherlock or the many femme fatales of detective noir. I'm also thinking of a couple of relationships that hold out promise of love to Raymond Chandler's detective Philip Marlowe, but never fully materialize, unless you count the late half-hearted novels, which I guess most fans don't. And then he continues a bit that this is exactly the point he's trying to make, that she's using these tropes, but actually showing growth and healing this time.
That makes sense.
So it was exciting for me to see that Kurt was on the same page as I was, and that the different love interests are a detective thing, and that mm-hmm. it's showing that the loner detective, because isn't that strike at the beginning, especially the loner mm-hmm. wanting Definitely. To be completely alone and not ask for help, guarding his heart.
Very Nora at the beginning, yeah.
The only difference is, as is the whole point, is that this detective is growing and changing. And she kind of takes us on that whole journey when it comes to being a loner and knowing who he loves and wants to be with.
Yes. He's slowly, over time, come to realize who it is he actually wants to be with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I just love the idea that, yes, she is taking this thing and changing it.
Flipping mm-hmm. it on its head, yeah.
And thank you, Kurt.
Thank you, Kurt.
Yes.
Anyway, to talk about what Jo actually said about this book, I completely agree with her that this was the most reckless choice of sexual partner. Completely ridiculous thing to do. Bijou, mm-hmm. that is.
Yeah, it really was just peak dumbassery from a strike. And he knew this as he was doing it. Which is what kills me.
How many times do you do something that you know is dumb as you're doing it?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Okay. Don't come out here attacking me like that. That's very rude. Very rude.
I'm just pointing out where strike is relatable.
Yeah, it felt for him like, you know, a big final hurrah of self-sabotage.
Go out with a bang, I guess.
Also feels relatable.
Literally.
Bang.
Go out with a Jesus Christ.
You're funny. You're funny.
Thank you. I'm here all week. It kind of made me laugh when she said at the very end, the almost, he's sort of getting there, because I think she doesn't want to give too much away.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what she said right before that is absolutely true. He knows what he wants now. He's all in. I'm dying over a strike who is all in.
Oh my God.
It's all or nothing. And he wants all. He wants all. But going back to the question, this was such a bit of a silly question to me, because of course being unattached doesn't change Strike's commitment to work, because he's literally always put work first. He's been 100%. Literally,
that's never been an issue.
He's been 110% committed to work, and then his girlfriend sort of gets slotted in around that. Has this guy even met Strike asking these questions?
We don't even know who is asking these questions.
Yeah, who came up with them?
It was very odd.
I thought the same thing.
A little bit of a weird question. Yeah.
It got a great answer out of Joe, so we'll forget.
It did. Mm-hmm. All right, let's jump into chapter 41.
All right. So in this chapter, Robin writes to Strike about the Revelation meetings and notices tension between Becca and Emily Purbright. And then for the epigraph, one is courageous and wishes to accomplish one's task no matter what happens. And that is from Hexagram 28. Preponderance of the Great.
I think this might be directly speaking about Robin telling Strike in her letter that she isn't ready to leave yet. And obviously, it takes a great amount of courage to remain there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part at the end of the chapter where she rips up the notes and releases them underneath the gate and onto the road. And she feels jealous of the scraps of paper as the wind takes them away, you know? Mm-hmm. So clearly, she wants to leave. But we know Robin. She wants to stay and finish what she's there to do.
Absolutely agree. Robin is the definition of courageous, and she's dedicated as hell. Also, so the sentences right after this in the judgment blew my mind, because it continues right after this. It continues, this leads into danger. The water rises over one's head. This is misfortune. But one incurs no blame in giving up one's life that the good and the right may prevail. There are things that are more important than life. For one, the water definitely does rise over Robin's head, and it is very unpleasant. I just love the conclusion that there are things that are more important, mostly because for Robin, yeah, she takes all these risks because for her, the pursuit of justice is more important. Also, this hexagram is all about how starting with caution and laying strong foundations when undertaking great endeavors is important. So it is very appropriate for these sets of chapters where she's laying that foundation of work.
All right. So we start the chapter on a pretty disturbing note where Robin is thinking about the revelation interrogation session she had been to where Kyle was the victim of that session.
Disturbing. Everything is disturbing.
That's most of this book, right?
Everything is disturbing. But yeah. What bothers me most about this is that Robin seems very disturbed by the others in the group and how they seem to enjoy being given permission to be vile and shout abuse at Kyle. But we know that Robin will have to play along too. And that must have been so hard for her.
Yeah.
Of course, we know she's doing it to survive. She has to. And I'm sure others might be doing that too. But I just think that this would be very hard for Robin. It goes completely against her nature to do that.
Yeah. I can only imagine how disturbing that must have been to both witness and participate in, especially for Robin. That must have been really hard.
The whole description of the revelation brings to mind, for me, 2 Minutes Hate from 1984. For those who haven't read it, 1984 is a dystopian novel by George Orwell. It's a warning about totalitarianism. And in the book, this authoritarian government is supported by a cult of personality that's centered on this figure of Big Brother. In the novel, it explores things like constant surveillance, propaganda, the ways that truth can be manipulated and manufactured, which, you know, there are certain parallels with the UHC here. But in the novel, the 2 Minutes Hate is a daily event where everyone sits in front of the screen and they are bombarded with images of the enemy. And in their fear and hatred, they start hurling abuse at the screen and they work themselves up into like a frenzy of hatred and violence for 2 minutes. I know that the structure of it is a bit different from the revelation in this book, but this quote from Orwell struck me, particularly with what you said above about having to participate in it, Lindsay. The horrible thing about the 2 Minutes Hate was not that one was obliged to act a part, but on the contrary, that it was impossible to avoid joining in. Within 30 seconds, any pretense was always unnecessary. A hideous ecstasy of fear and vindictiveness, a desire to kill, to torture, to smash faces in with a sledgehammer, seemed to flow through the whole group of people like an electric current, turning one even against one's will into a grimacing, screaming lunatic. And yet the rage that one felt was an abstract, undirected emotion which could be switched from one object to another like the flame of a blow lamp. I just feel like being swept up in this tide of anger and hatred, it seems very similar to what is happening to this group of people in Revelation. Yeah. And Robin manages to stay outside of it because of her analytical detachment of what she's there to do. Her real self is at a different level from this. And sometimes in the novel 1984, Winston's thoughts during the section show some sort of fleeting similarities in that regard. But this groupthink, the infectious nature of a powerful shared emotion surrounding you, sucking you in, I think that's very much what's happening to the other recruits here. The structure of the revelation is it's designed to release all of their suppressed negative emotions and channel them and direct them for a specific purpose. So for the UHC, the purpose here is to turn them on each other, yes, but also on themselves in a way. So they're breaking the bonds between them, obviously by having them attack each other, but it's pushing them to act in a way that would probably go against the moral codes that they follow on the outside of the cult. It's severing them from their essential tether to the things they've always believed.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're severed from yourself, I mean, it's easier to suck you into this group. In 1984, the 2 Minutes Hate is to unite the party members against a common external enemy. And that happens in the UHC too at points. But this breaking down of bonds between others and between your own self, I feel like that's an essential first step for a cult.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's very powerful, very frightening moment.
Would you call it communal abuse?
Yeah, pretty much. A far more accurate description than revelation, but seems slightly less likely to draw in recruits. Just slightly less.
Yeah, I mean,
come join us for our communal abuse.
Next up, drowning in a dark pool in the basement. Yeah, branding is a very important aspect of running a cult, isn't it? Because no one's going to fall for your tactics without the clever branding that makes it seem exciting.
Robin also thinks that this kind of abuse going on was justified as being part of primal response therapy. I looked this up. It's a real thing, although Google comes back with just primal therapy.
Mm.
When I say real, I mean it does exist, not that it's credible, because it says that it's regarded as one of the least credible forms of psychotherapy.
Least credible? You don't say.
Yeah.
Surprise. I wonder if Zhao had a big hand in developing this specific thing at the farm, because using techniques and knowledge from his psychologist training to sort of up the effectiveness of their indoctrination and also give them a veneer of legitimacy seems like something he'd absolutely be doing as a principal. Also, I just realized that Robin the psychologist, by the way, do you remember when Strike called her the psychologist in Silkworm?
Of course.
Always keen to hear from the psychologist. How cute is that?
Very cute.
She is the opposite to Zhao here. She's set in opposition to him because both have a psychology background. Mm-hmm. Both are using it in the context of this cult, one to support it, one to bring it down. But for both their psychology training, it's faded into the background and becomes secondary to their actual career. So Zhao is pretending to be an actual medical doctor, dispensing care he is not qualified to dispense.
Mm-hmm.
But Robin is an actual detective, and she's actually going to penetrate this morass of filth and burn it to the ground. I don't know where I was going with this, actually, but they're just two opposites. And keep in mind that it's Zhao's patient, Jacob, that gives Robin the first key to escaping and bringing down this cult. So his fraud doctoring let her real detective skills sink their teeth in.
Mm.
The two branching paths of psychology, justice and quackery.
Justice and quackery. There's the title of the episode. I think where you're going with this is that Robin is better than these people in literally every single way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yeah, you're right. It's the battle of the psychologists, and Robin wins.
Two psychologists center, one psychologist leaves. It's psychologist Thunderdome. Ah, yeah. I love it.
But the idea of this therapy is to re-experience childhood pain felt rather than conceptual memories in an attempt to resolve pain.
Which on some level, I mean, I guess sort of makes sense, but it doesn't really pan out.
Oh, you're hitting on a sore spot with me. A little pet peeve, a little frequent annoyance, Kenz. Thank you for bringing it up, because I have seen so many people on the internet talk about how certain activities basically function as therapy because they let people reenact their trauma, except being in control of it. And you're right. It sounds right on the surface. If you don't think about it too much, you're like, oh yeah, okay, that checks out. But that's not how trauma works. All one does by re-experiencing and reenacting trauma is to reinforce and deepen the pathways that the damage that that trauma causes. It's just adding more trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It strengthens sort of the neural connections that are formed in that original experience rather than rewiring your brain and making new different connections in a healthier way. It makes me big mad. Many things do, to be fair.
About to say, that's part of a long list.
It's a brand. Lindsay's like, just let her go. Just wait it out. She'll run out of steam.
The descriptions in the criticism section of the Wikipedia article about this are really fun, because it's been described as questionable in theory and dangerous in practice, which, imagine that.
Wow.
This critique from Polish-Swiss psychologist Alice Miller is really excellent, where it says that her view was that primal therapy could be dangerous when conducted by inadequately trained therapists, that there was, quote, too much faith, unquote, in cathartic discharge, and that the structure of the initial 3-week intensive could provide opportunities for unscrupulous therapists.
The whole too much faith in cathartic discharge rings very true to me, because so it's like how people will recommend that you scream at or hit pillows when you're angry to let out the emotions safely. But the thing is, this doesn't actually make you less angry. It just, again, reinforces those neural connections between feeling anger and screaming and hitting in the brain. It makes us more angry over time because we're feeding those emotional expressions and making them stronger.
Does this mean that our emotions closet isn't actually helping us?
We do seem to be feeling more and more emotions over time.
That's Joe's fault, though. That's not our fault.
That is. I fell down a bit of a research hole looking into this because it was only my sort of half-remembered stuff that I'd read sometime, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't making up nonsense. But the theory of using catharsis, like venting, to avoid repression and neurosis comes, of course, from Freud. It's the idea that people are like steam engines, right? Our emotions build up inside of us. And if they're not vented, then we explode or develop complexes. But actual studies more recently have demonstrated that venting anger doesn't reduce aggression and can actually increase it.
I don't think that the UHC cares whether or not it's credible, because their purpose is not to heal these people. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
Instead, you get some trauma. You get some trauma. Everybody gets some trauma.
Yeah, exactly. UHC is actively, explicitly seeking to break their members psychologically in order to more easily manipulate and control them. It's working great. It's like they research best practices and they're like, let's do the opposite.
There's a paragraph here that describes the constant indoctrination and the horrible videos that they're being shown and all of the other horrible things she's experiencing. And then it says that her only real defense against these things was to remind herself what she's there to do.
In this little sum up, though, I love that we get a little primer to all of the cult special lingo, because when all of the different terms and acronyms are listed one after another like this, they seem so silly. Like, oh, he's gone DV, she's a BP. It's ridiculous. But it's also clear that these changes in language are a really effective way to create an in-group out of this cult's members. It makes them feel like they're part of a special club, and it binds them together, setting them apart from the rest of society, right? They buy into the lingo, which gets them the validation, but then using that language actually changes the way they think. So this time reading through, I read this part. I'm going to quote it. Anyone who's listening, tell me if this feels familiar to you. Members were regularly bombarded with dreadful images and statistics about the outside world, sometimes for hours at a time. Even though Robin knew this was being done to create a sense of urgency, she doubted anyone of normal empathy could fail to feel distressed and anxious after being forced to look at hundreds upon hundreds of images of starving and wounded children, or learning the statistics on people trafficking and moral poverty, or hearing how the rainforest would be entirely destroyed within another 2 decades. This is literally describing what I'm doing to myself when I'm doom scrolling for hours upon hours on my phone. Honest to God, this is literally just reading the news on social media, this exact thing. And it's like, no wonder I'm depressed and anxious. I'm literally cult brainwashing myself, but not getting the happy endorphins that the cult promises and validation give.
Mm-hmm.
My take home from this is that I need to start using that app on my phone that limits my scrolling time.
You could do it other ways too. I have unfollowed certain things, certain words that make things difficult for me, that stress me out. It's the only way to function. I don't think human beings are meant to know every single horrible thing that's going on in the world that social media now allows. It's too much.
Our brains can't handle it.
Yeah, especially if you struggle with things like anxiety. So knowing that Robin has struggled, it's hard to read that she's been forced to do this because I understand how she must be feeling because, we've all done this.
And knowing how much empathy she has too. She's a very empathic person.
I think most of this is giving us updates on what's been going on over the last few weeks. I'm glad we didn't have to go through each week in real time, or however you'd say that, right? In the case. I'm all about this time skip. Let's skip some of these.
Same. I want to skip as many moments of awfulness on this farm as we possibly can.
Yeah.
Although, on the other hand, if we don't suffer through the farm with Robin, then the emotional catharsis of the rescue just doesn't hit quite the same way, does it?
Yeah. We got to suffer a little bit.
A little bit of suffering. Yeah. Not too much. I think Joe strikes the right balance for us.
You're going to suffer, but you're going to be happy about it.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's so true. Once again, Ron Weasley speaking truth.
Some of the updates include that she hasn't been able to get close to Will or Emily, but she's noticed that Will and Lynn are definitely Ching's parents, and both are trying to maintain a parental relationship with her.
The discussion of how Will and Lynn are risking severe penalties just for showing any tiny amount of affection or guidance to Ching. I think these two are at their core good people and good parents, which is amazing because Lynn spent her entire life in this cult and knows nothing else. We've seen Will be super invested and dogmatic about the cult's teachings, but their internal sense of what being a parent should mean overcomes all of that. And nothing is going to stop them from doing what they feel in their hearts to be right. I'm just having all kinds of feelings about this sweet little baby girl. And I desperately need an update a few years down the road about how they're all doing, because I feel like the affection that they're managing to give her now, that they're risking horrific punishments to give her in this most crucial period of child development, that might have been the thing that saved her from that severe, fundamental, core emotional trauma that being having no affection in that stage gives you, you know?
She's going to be okay. She's very young and has so many loving people around her now.
Yeah.
But the way you're describing Will and Lynn is kind of reminding me of the Malfoys. Obviously, I like Will and Lynn much better than Lucius and Narcissa. But we have two parents who find themselves in this overwhelming situation that they're caught up in with no escape and a dictator controlling their lives.
Yeah.
And all they care about is getting their child to safety. That is the Malfoys.
Oh my God, you're so right. You know what? In the end, it all comes down to one of the most central ideas in all of Joe's work. What's the most powerful force in the world? It's love. love is what makes it possible to do things that you thought were impossible. A tiny seed of love at the core of a terrible person, I'm looking at you, Malfoy, can make them turn away from the evil thing that they've devoted their lives to, right? Love makes people risk everything. God, such a powerful moral message.
Another update from Robin, though, is that she's sensing the flesh object drama between the Purbright sisters, Emily and Becca.
Oh my God. I'm just laughing at the phrase flesh object drama because it sounds like how an alien would describe it.
It really does. I want a reality show called Flesh Objects where a bunch of families are thrown into some kind of like boiler room situation and told to keep their relationship to each other secret no matter what. Because if the other contestants guess who's related, they'll get voted off, which is basically just Diane and Ross and the Traitors.
Except
everyone is related to someone else, right?
But we still root for Diane and Ross. Obviously.
Obviously. Yes. They're the best.
Yeah. If that whole family just had a reality show, I'd watch it.
Oh my God. Yes.
They're all hilarious.
I'd watch the hell out of a reality show about that family. Care Logan, get this going. We want to see it. The audience is here for this. Strike while the iron's hot. Strike.
Yeah.
Robin wondered whether Becca was afraid of being tarnished by the faint aura of disgrace which hung over the shaven-headed Emily, or whether there was another, more personal source of animosity. The sisters seemed united in one thing only, disdain for the woman who'd brought them into the world. Not once did Robin see any sign of warmth towards, or even acknowledgement of, Louise from either of her daughters.
First of all, I can't remember when I first started worrying about Robin's head getting shaved, but if I wasn't already, I was now. Seeing that it is a clear sign of being disgraced and punishment, I knew this was a potential danger. It terrified me. I wonder if growing up in this cult makes you a little more jaded to this and not quite as bothered. Maybe I just hope that for Emily, you know, that it doesn't bother her the way it would bother me.
Yeah.
I think it's possible you're right. Either she's jaded or she's just dissociating her way through it, which honestly, I wouldn't be surprised by.
Yeah. But talking about their shared hatred for their mother, Louise, do we think that this comes from the same place? Because I would assume, as I think we talked about, that Emily hates her for bringing her there in the first place. But Becca is all about the UHC. So where is her hatred for Louise coming from?
I assumed as well that Emily hates Louise because Louise dragged them into the cult. My best guess for Becca hating her would be, because Louise is being punished or shunned. Mm-hmm. So she's doing the usual cult practice of hating or ignoring, maybe with an extra bit of loathing because she's really committed to the cult's ideology and is rejecting her flesh objects extra hard.
Yeah, maybe she's disgusted by their low status and doesn't want to be associated.
That's probably it. She doesn't want to be.
She's so much better than them.
Yeah.
She's so much more pure spirit than they are.
She's gone pure spirit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we know Louise was never allowed to leave the farm, right? She is actually pretty low status. Becca would not want to have any association with her.
Mm.
Well, that's what you get for bringing your kids into a cult, I guess. Don't do it.
More tips from Pools.
Sorry if that's not sympathetic enough to Louise. I feel for her, but don't bring your kids into a cult. It's not going to end well for anyone.
Well, that's the problem. People don't know that it's happening.
It's true. It's true. It's a hard tip to follow.
Robin is about to go to the Rock for the third time, and it says that it's still nerve-wracking to do, even though she craves the contact from her life outside.
I think I know what she craves.
Yeah, we all know what she's craving.
It's not chocolate.
We all know which part of her outside life she's craving contact with. Come on.
Right. You know what must have also been hard about this is not falling asleep. Because with how little sleep they get, it must have been so hard for her to force herself to stay awake.
Yeah, like how effective is adrenaline against that level of bone deep exhaustion, you know? Yeah.
I'm astounded she never missed a Rock day simply because of that. She fell asleep.
Yeah.
But I guess the power of seeing the handwriting of the man you love, that's the only thing that can overcome sleep and the promise of chocolate.
When Robin opened the Rock, she saw a letter from Strike, a note in Ryan's handwriting, and to her delight, a small bar of Cadbury's dairy milk. Easing herself behind a tree, she ripped the wrapping off the chocolate and devoured it in a few bites, so hungry she couldn't slow down to savor it.
This is still one of the sweetest things in the book for me, literally, because it's chocolate.
He's fending off the Dementors, you know? I love that as soon as he gets confirmation that she's underfed, he immediately starts including food with his letters.
Yeah.
And before anyone starts, yes, I know that on a realistic level, a protein bar would have been more practical and kept her fuller for longer. Yeah, whatever. I like the idea of chocolate being like just yet another anchor to the real world for her and like a little symbol of rebellion because they can't have sugar there. You know,
yeah.
Rowena Ellis may be okay with a protein bar, but let me tell you something. Robin Ellicott is not. Also, I really want to believe that that's her favorite candy bar.
Are people mad that he gave her chocolate?
Well, protein bars would have been more practical. It would have given her more calories, more nutrients.
But yes, that has been a thing that people have criticized him for. Because like, well, but it's not going to keep her very full. That's not very helpful.
God's sakes. Come on. Add it to the list of reasons people want to. Okay.
It would make sense from a logistical standpoint to give protein bars. From a literary, symbolic standpoint, obviously the chocolate is essential.
It is a book, y'all.
From an emotional.
It's because Strike knows her. He knows that this will cheer her up. Mm-hmm. My God. We're going to complain about Strike giving her chocolate. Good Lord. It's because he knows her. She loves chocolate.
Yeah, she does. I was very curious and procrastinated on doing something important, I think. So I went to do a search for chocolate in these books to see if there was like a symbolic pattern. And guess what? I am seeing some stuff here.
Tell us all about it.
Yeah, all the time chocolate shows up. So the very first day they met, Robin brings Strike chocolate biscuits. Remember how amazed he was that she conjured them out of thin air?
So
remember
amazed.
How he remembers that 5 books later and is still amazed at her?
I do.
She gives him Cornish chocolate for his birthday and silkworm. And he's touched. Aww. She brings him chocolate biscuits again at the end of that book when he gives her the surveillance course. Very cute. And then we get to the third book. She deprives herself of chocolate in Career of Evil, right? And she says that her chocolate habit is jeopardizing her ability to fit into her wedding dress. So here we have chocolate is set up as equaling happiness and love. And that's not Matthew. Chocolate and her relationship with Matthew just don't go together. But Strike gives her a Twix when she's attacked, but then she's not allowed to eat it. Like, she's not allowed to eat Strike, symbolically.
Yeah, I get it.
At this point. And then the only time it's mentioned that they eat chocolate, either of them in Lethal White, is the chocolate bars that Robin buys for them both in the hospital vending machine after she shows up for him when Jack is sick. And that's the moment that their relationship is properly restored. And it's marked by shared eating of chocolate bars. And then there is so much chocolate in Troubled Blood that I can't even start. I was shocked at how much chocolate is in this book. It's an actual theme. Robin is depriving herself again, but treating herself with real chocolate whenever Strike is either with her or in her thoughts, right? It's very cute. And she can't tell whether she's happy because of the real brownie or because of Strike. Chocolates show up for the first time in a negative way as generic or bad gifts. And they're strongly associated both with Margot loving chocolate and with her resting place because chocolate shows up constantly with the Athorns. Yeah. But they're also associated with Janice as a murder weapon.
Also because the chocolate biscuits at the Athorns are the same that Janice brings them in chapter 20 when they first interview her. So it's connected to her there too.
Chocolates are becoming a bit sinister sometimes. They're becoming a bit more complex. Strike walks Robin through the chocolate department to buy her perfume at the end of the book. So chocolate is becoming more complex.
And when he tells her the truth about the chocolates too, which is adorable.
That is very cute. He's opening up about the chocolates and bringing chocolate back to its real meaning of love.
Mm. Shaggable you. That's when he tells
Never
her.
Never get over that line.
Yeah, but the symbolic meaning of chocolate is deepening here as both of them face so much stress and work through the conflicts in their relationship. And we see how, you know, usually something that seems to be good, it can be evil inside. And then at the end of Ink Black Heart, Robin brings Strike healthy dark chocolate, signifying a new leaf and, you know, her continuing support and love for him. Aww. So what's my point in all this? I have a point, promise. So Robin is not just a chocolate girl, although she totally is a chocolate girl. I feel like chocolate is literally a love language for her because gifts of chocolate mark so many significant moments between her and Strike. And when she eats real chocolate, it's often either with Strike or, like I said, with her thoughts of Strike. And you can see when her relationships are in trouble or unwanted when she doesn't enjoy chocolate. So low-fat hot chocolate, the salted caramels from Morris that Strike repeats, showing his lack of consideration for her. So when Strike is giving her chocolate in this book, it's definitely about the fact that he knows her, but it's also so much more because he's literally giving her back the love that she's unconsciously been giving him for so long. He's speaking the language she understands to tell her that she's loved, because chocolate in these books is symbolically tied to love, true love or false love or evil disguised as love. It's all there. hear.
You are so right. I don't want to hear any talk of protein bars after that speech.
Yeah,
beautiful.
It's the symbolic value is way more important than the practical consideration
Thank
of
you,
calories.
Pools.
You're welcome.
Beautiful. It's also making me think of Ted and Joan and the chocolate biscuits that she hides from him, but that he still has in this book when Strike goes to visit.
It's a sign of enduring love.
Yes, wonderfully sweet analysis, Pools. I feel like you could do a whole chocolate blog post.
Yeah, I might. I would like to write a blog post on that, actually.
Okay, the first letter she reads is Murphy's letter.
Well, she's clearly saving the best for last.
Yeah, I feel like Murphy's letter is Murphy's law because everything that could go wrong with this letter goes wrong with this letter.
Oh my God, it's so true. And that's definitely why his name's Murphy, by the way.
I know, I agree. I totally agree. Let's read it in sections and break it down, shall we?
Oh man, I'm ready for it.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
I'm not a fan of this letter. And listen, as I've said before, I don't think anything I'm about to say makes him a bad guy. Mm-hmm. I just think he's a bad match for Robin. And I think my opinion on this is backed up by how Robin feels about it herself.
I agree with you on this. Mm-hmm. The letter didn't impress me at all. It's not necessarily full of red flags, but I'd say that there are some pink flags flying here that are specifically about his fit for Robin.
Right. I agree.
Yeah.
So he starts off, dear Robin.
He starts out great. I'll give him credit where credit is due. Great opening. Mm-hmm. Well done.
Yeah. I, for one, am just glad that we didn't get any horrifying pet names like, you know, Cormy Wormy or Wan Wan.
Wan Wan.
I think I'd be a little surprised if Strike and Robin did this with each other. But I mean, I don't think I'd hate it. Obviously, I'm a bit biased.
Yeah. I feel like we've talked about what they would use as endearments for each other before.
Mm-hmm.
I could totally see Strike calling her love or gorgeous or maybe even like a sweetheart, darling, if she's upset and he's comforting her or something.
Mm-hmm. I know we've said we think he'll say love because we've seen Ted called Joan love.
Yep, that was it.
I mean, I can see him with those kind of names because they're traditional, but maybe they'll both surprise us and pull out a Molly Wobbles or something.
Oh my God,
that was so fucking cute. Next, he says, it was great to hear from you. I was getting worried.
Okay, I think you could argue this is fine. However, if I was Robin, this might make me feel a little guilty for forgetting to write him that first night.
Yeah, on the surface, this seems fine, but centering this on his feelings when his girlfriend is in a literal fucking cult, like she needs to feel any more anxious or guilty.
Right.
I know it's a small comment and he's probably not doing this on purpose to make her feel bad, but it's just such a contrast to Strike, who's worried as hell about her, but doesn't let on to her because she's there to do the job and what she needs is support and a route to something real.
My guilt trip radar might be a bit oversensitive, you know, as an ex-Catholic, it's legendary, but this still smells like guilt trip to me. I feel the guilt trip.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
It's subtle, but I think it's there. Mm-hmm. Also, my question is, so we know that he didn't send a note for her the first week. Did he send her one for that second pickup? Or did he wait to respond to her note that she sent him, meaning that week three was the first time she heard from him? Because we don't get a definitive thought on this from Robin.
I don't know.
Because listen, if he didn't write her first on that second week, then this line is especially egregious to me.
Yeah, we're going to have to look that up.
I couldn't see any thought about her reading a note from Murphy or Strike putting one in the rock for week two.
Okay.
Eagle-eyed readers might be able to find something I missed. I might have to go back and read it. But if he waited to hear from her before writing her a note so that she didn't hear from him until week three, I'd be like, wow.
I get what you're saying.
Wow.
All right, what comes next?
So this next part, the farm sounds bizarre, although being a country girl, you're probably not hating it as much as I would.
I get that maybe he's trying to be lighthearted and maybe he's trying to make jokes, but this feels really insensitive. I'm sure, knowing Robin, that she's downplayed things, but Murphy is completely capable of using Google. He has to be aware of the allegations that have been made against the UHC, telling her that she might not hate it because she's a country girl. Come on, dude. This was insensitive
at best.
Again, that's one of those things that seems well-intentioned, but it just doesn't land. No amount of previous farm work or helping out with her uncle or whatever is going to help with brainwashing and all the horrible things that she's going through. It's like he's just pretending that she's running off to a farm for a while and kind of undermining the seriousness of what she's there to do.
Yeah. This line makes me incredibly curious about what she actually told him in that week two letter to elicit this response. So walk through my logic with me here. We know that she definitely wouldn't have had time to write him a whole novel about how things are going. So she probably kept it to the highlights, right?
Mm-hmm.
I find it hard to believe that she focused on just the farmy parts, like the animals, the fresh air. There were, you know, outside farm stuff, right? Because to me, the only thing that would make the country girl response make sense is if she focused on those aspects of the animal care and the nature immersion. But the thing is that if she did focus on those farm parts and didn't talk about any of the miserable cult stuff to him, then why did he say it sounded bizarre? Because that wouldn't make sense. So what did she describe to get both the country girl downplaying and the bizarre as if she described what the fuckery is going on there? There is nothing I can envision Robin having written where these two things together are an appropriate reply.
I just think it's a brief update on everything. You know, we have to do all these lectures and all of these things, and there's lots of farm work. That's the only thing. Okay, sounds bizarre, country girl.
It's weird to me.
No, I agree. Yeah. I think this is a weird thing for him to have said. It's insensitive. Yeah. And maybe he's trying to be funny, make a joke, but notice that now when Robin is away from him, she doesn't fake laugh because it's not funny at all.
Right.
It's actually horrifying.
It's not a funny
joke. And I really hope that you're right about Robin stopping herself laughing at Murphy's not funny quips in the future.
Oh, me too. Not just because it'd be fun to get that right, but I don't know. I don't like watching Robin do that.
Yeah, not a fan either. It reminds me of her thoughts while she was texting with Morris in Troubled Blood.
But that's why I like it when she doesn't laugh at Strike's jokes, where she's just like, haha, you're hilarious.
Well, it's real.
That's honesty, right? That's real.
And he is funny. She does laugh when he's funny.
He is hilarious. She does laugh when he's funny. But when he's making stupid corny jokes, she's like, ha.
All right, what's next?
Not much news this end. Works busy. Currently on a new murder case, but it lacks something without the involvement of a hot female private detective.
I remember literally going, when I first read this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's unfair, because what would I say if Strike made a joke about her being a hot private detective when they're together? I don't know, but I think in this circumstance, it doesn't feel like the moment to do it.
This is so not the time for those kind of comments. And even if Strike and Robin had been in a relationship while Robin was undercover at Chapman Farm, he wouldn't have said stuff like this in letters to her.
I agree. I don't like this line. I just don't like it. The way he's said it frames Robin as sort of like a fun, pretty accessory to his murder solving, right? Because she's the hot female. Yeah, I guess she's a private detective. How cute. Rather than being a brilliant detective in herself, I can't imagine Strike ever making this specific joke because, one, it's not funny. But two, I feel like Strike would never belittle her by suggesting that her physical attractiveness is her main contribution to their detective partnership.
I don't know if I think that that's what Murphy is, like, belittling her to her appearance.
It feels like it to me.
Okay.
But that might be personal preference. But we know that Strike would genuinely be missing working with her and bouncing ideas off of her, not looking at her while they do work, although he does like to do that too.
Of course.
But we know this because that's what he misses most about her always, is talking to her. Always. Her brain and her voice. And I feel like Murphy doesn't actually value Robin's intelligence and skills the way he should, as much as he should. He might recognize that she's smart, but I don't think he gets it. Not the way Strike does.
I mean, like I said, I wouldn't mind if Strike mentioned to her how attractive he finds her. I do want that.
Yes. He needs to tell her.
I don't necessarily think that that's what this means with Murphy. I just think that this is not the place to do it.
Yeah.
So next he says, I had a long phone conversation with your mother last night. She's worried about you, but I talked her down.
Again, I think that this shows that he doesn't know Robin very well. If he thought that this was the right thing to say, I think that Strike would know very well not to say this.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what he would even tell Linda, because Robin's hardly told him anything that's going on in her letters anyway.
That's the scariest part. What are they talking about? It makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, this is the part I was like, oh, hell no. I would be super uncomfortable if I was Robin, thinking about what Murphy was telling Linda in a long phone conversation. But also, and this is curious to me, a long conversation with her mother, but absolutely no news about how her family's doing to impart. No messages from them. Just an unnecessary and counterproductive attempt to make yourself look good and valuable to Robin while still laying in the guilt. Okay, Ryan.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah, it does make it worse. Point. No, they're doing this. They send their love.
Nothing. Just
nothing.
your mom's worried, but look at how great I am. I totally calmed her down. Like,
Honestly, I know this seems so unlikely because of Linda's likely feelings about Strike, but I think it would have been better for Robin if Strike had kept Linda informed, because I think he would have talked to her about the Robin he knows. He would have said how strong and brave and capable she is. But also, I just think we're probably going to learn more about this little relationship that Linda and Murphy have developed. And I don't think that Robin's going to like it.
Oh, yeah. She's going to hate it. I have no doubts that it'll have shades of that alliance that Robin, you know, was imagining Matthew and Linda having in a previous book. What was it? Was it Career of Evil, I think it was?
Yeah, I can see that.
I totally agree. And I don't think Robin was imagining the two of them whispering to each other in Career of Evil. She saw that. True, she didn't know what they were whispering about, but pretty sus behavior. So yeah, I agree. I think it's going to circle back around to that again, Kenz.
I really like that point, Lindsay, that you made about Strike talking to Linda about the Robin that he knows, because I'm sure that Linda, and I mean, both of her parents, really, but mainly Linda, knows that Robin is brave and resilient and all these other things. But it would be really interesting to read them hearing it coming directly from Strike.
It would be really good. I am kind of looking forward to any consequences of Murphy and Linda, you know, kind of being on this weird team, if that makes sense. I just can't help but feel like it's going to lead to something really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm curious what you think is going to happen.
I'm thinking about what you said, Kenz, about Linda and Matthew whispering in Career of Evil. And I think that Linda might team up with the conventional man in Robin's life because it's what she wants for her daughter. And I guess I'm thinking that it could be the catalyst to get them to this fight or resolution that I've been expecting, where Robin might be really honest about who she wants and doesn't want with Linda, and bring that resolution that I've been waiting for.
I could totally see this being the thing that sparks that huge fight that they need to have, because Robin needs to express her truth to Linda. She needs to do it, but she only ever seems to be able to do that forcefully enough when she's super angry in a fight, like the nightmare dinner fight with Strike and Troubled Blood. She and Linda need their own nightmare dinner to get everything out, air all the grievances so that you can get to work on fixing them. You know?
She did a little better in Ink Black Heart.
She did better.
Where she says, you know, I am home. This is what I want. Yes, you do want that for me.
Yeah, she's getting there.
But there needs to be more, and it needs to involve Strike, I think. Yeah,
I can't wait. Oh, God, I need book 8. Is it out yet?
All right, Kenz, what's the next line?
My sister in San Sebastian wants us to go over there in July because she's gagging to meet you. There'd be worse ways of celebrating you getting out of that place.
Again, not terrible, but I think my reaction was the same as Robin's, that she can't be thinking about that right now. And maybe this is also a little insensitive to her current situation. I think these little things are what make me believe that he doesn't fully respect her career, because he's kind of just like, okay, well, when you're done with this little trip, I'd really like it if we did this.
Yeah, I get what you mean. This, again, is one of those things that is well-intentioned, and I feel like it's supposed to help her feel connected to the outside world, but again, just completely misses the mark. He just really doesn't know how to support her in the way that she needs.
I don't really think that he intended to make her feel connected to the outside world in the way that I think Strike does. I think this is much more about what Murphy wants. He's planning things for when she's done with this, and maybe his intention is to give her something to look forward to, or to push her to leave sooner rather than later, which I wouldn't really consider a bad thing, but I just don't think that he's fully understanding what she's in right now. I just think the contrast with Strike's understanding is so huge. And it's not because Strike is getting more case details.
I agree. This whole letter feels so self-centered to me. It's Murphy and his feelings, what he's done, what he wants to do. Like you said, there's no consideration of what Robin needs to hear, or better case, there's no understanding of what it is she needs to hear, just ignorance. I, that's all I hear this whole letter.
Anyway, I'm really missing you, so please don't join up and never come back. Love, Ryan. Kiss, kiss, kiss.
I don't love him joking about her really joining. This again feels insensitive. I can't imagine what it must have felt like for Robin to be in the middle of such a nightmare and having someone in your life make a joke that you're going to choose to stay there forever. I think this is showing more of Murphy's insecurities about her being away. I think he's looking for a response of, oh, I would never, I can't wait to see you again, when the reality of it is that it's just not a funny thing to joke about.
It's in really poor taste. Come on, dude. Why would you even say that?
I think the thing that is lacking so much, especially in contrast with Strike's note, is asking if she's okay and if she needs or wants him to get her out. He probably has more legal authority to show up and get her. Why doesn't he ask how she really is? I don't think he ever does.
Yeah, that's a great question. Why didn't he offer to try and get her out or ask how she really was?
I suppose a generous reading of him here would be that he knows it's not his place to interfere with her work by like marching in and flashing his badge.
Well, but he could ask.
Yeah, he could ask.
I don't mean just showing up, obviously.
Yeah, I think that letting her know that he'll pull the cop card if she needs him to would be a perfectly fine and supportive thing to do. Like I said, generous reading, not my reading. I think he just had no idea that she might actually end up trapped there and needing rescue. He doesn't understand the severity of this. Even though he had enough of an idea about the danger to give her a lecture on it after ejaculating. So,
well, that's what I don't understand.
I'm confused, Murphy. Is it dangerous or not?
That's what I don't understand. Yeah. Why he's seeming to make these jokes and being insensitive about it when he clearly was there for the beginning part of this investigation. And he has access to Google. If I were him, I would be looking and trying to find out everything I could to figure out what she's facing. I don't understand the downplaying or the jokes and never asking how she really is. I just don't get it.
No.
Going back to, I think it was what you were saying earlier, Pools. I don't think I had picked up on that in my previous read, the I, me, my, because the whole letter is really, it's just riddled with I statements, centering the letter on him and his feelings and his plans for the future, but not really engaging with Robin beyond how she fits into his plan, which honestly, it tracks so far with how we've seen their relationship go.
I'm picking up the same vibe. I kind of am. I'm not going
to
lie.
I mean, the counter to that argument is that Robin doesn't say that she's not in with his plans.
Also true.
Whether in her notes about what they're doing this summer or children, Robin doesn't say.
And then we get to the last line of Murphy's note, which is P.S. Your plants are still alive.
This is the first time I think we realized that Murphy is in charge of her plants. And I was unhappy about this. I really wanted Pat to be the one. Like, I wanted them to be at the office.
Yeah.
But he's really lucky he didn't kill her philodendron, because I think I would have jumped into the book and murdered him.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah. Hard same on the feelings of justifiable homicide if he had killed her philodendron.
Right.
I do wonder, though, at what point during her stay he killed all of her other plants, though.
In all fairness to Murphy, I've never been able to keep a plant alive in my life, except for my heartleaf philodendron that I got shortly after Ink Black Heart.
Amazing.
I also got the Monstera plant. I think that's how you say it. That's described as being at the entrance of North Grove. Mm-hmm. And I've had that one for about 6 months now, and it's still alive. So really, I think it's just an Ink Black Heart miracle, because everything else I've always killed.
I am also a serial plant murderer, but I feel like Robin probably left pretty detailed instructions on how to keep them alive. So I'm not giving Murphy a pass on this.
It literally wouldn't have mattered if someone gives me any detailed whatever. I would still kill them. So I can't blame him for this. I'm just really glad Phyllis survived.
Yeah, me too.
I know there are going to be people who think that I'm being hard on him for this letter and that it isn't as bad as I'm saying. But I think the big issue here is that he doesn't know her well enough to know what she needs. And he's kind of minimizing what she's doing there, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. He just doesn't know her well enough. And he doesn't realize that he doesn't know her well enough, you know?
No.
I wonder, I think you mentioned this a minute ago, but I wonder if any of this is down to Robin not really letting him in. I mean,
of course.
Not that this is her fault, but yeah, she mentioned that there was a certain guardedness in the relationship. And I'm certain she's much more open and authentic about herself with Strike. See the fake laughs, for example. And she's not invested enough in their relationship to be actually vulnerable and open with him. So yeah, of course he doesn't really know her.
I'm not saying that any of this makes him a bad or evil guy. I think he and Lorelai will be very happy someday. They'll have
them.
The exact same complaints.
Yeah.
The exact same. I'm just kidding about that. But I do think that when it comes to Robin, he's just not the one. And I think he's making Strike look really good here by how much Strike understands what she needs and always makes her feel comforted and reassured.
One of my favorite things about Strike is the fact that he has always made Robin feel safe. Like you said, comforted, reassured. When she hugged him in Lethal White and his arms felt like home. That's what he is to her. He's her safe space. He's the place where she can be herself and know that he sees her and understands her.
It's one of my favorite things in Troubled Blood in chapter 45, when she thinks about that he's never made her feel uncomfortable, always felt safe.
Same.
But let's just read what Robin thinks to back me up here. So it says, in spite of her recent ingestion of chocolate, this letter didn't do much to lift Robin's spirits. Hearing that Ryan and her mother were worried about her did nothing to calm the guilt and fear the UHC was busy inculcating in her. nor could she think of things like summer holidays right now, when every day seemed to last a week.
I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Literally everything we just said, but summed up in one concise sentence.
Notice the reference to chocolate lifting one's spirit, though.
Right. Here, the chocolate alone can't do it. It's the combo of chocolate and strike, because chocolate can only work when it comes with love.
I think you really got to write that blog post as an argument. It's a really good one.
The secret ingredient?
Love. Is love. If you were Murphy, how would you write to Robin? As someone who's not part of the case, just her personal life, how can we help him improve this letter?
Uh-oh, fun project.
He needs it. He needs it.
He needs the help.
I think that we should just cut straight to the chase and say, I've decided to move to San Sebastian and join Interpol, and we can't be together anymore. Go be with Strike and be happy.
Amen.
That's a great letter. That would cheer her up. I feel like that would cheer her up.
One less thing to worry about. Just kidding. But seriously, have the amount of I statements and replace them with either questions or comments on what she's told him. And that would be a good starting place.
If I were him, I'd start with sharing news that she'd actually want to hear. Like some kind of anecdote about her family that's funny or nice, you know? Maybe like the latest update on some horrible coworker drama that he's been sharing with her, like the installment of Peggy in the copy room, hogging the paper or something. I don't know. Just, or maybe something big that's happened in the news. Something, a bit of fresh air to remind her about the outside world that isn't laden with guilt and expectations, right? I would also, if I were him, ask if there was anything I could do to help her, information she needs, something he can pass along with his note, a quick rescue with his badge if she needs it, anything. Maybe be like, can I stick 40 pounds in this rock in case you need to make a quick escape one night and buy a bus ticket? Just some kind of offer of concrete help if she says the word. And I guess my third tip would be, definitely include that you miss her. Sure, but maybe also say something encouraging about how he knows she'll definitely be able to find the dirt she needs on this church because she's a brilliant and amazing detective. And also he misses her beautiful face if he wants to get in the reference to her looks there. That would be cute. Basically, just model it after Strike's letter because he really nailed it, I think.
He really did. I mean, I think that was J.K. Rowling's intention to show us not only who knows her better, but who is the right man and partner for her.
So let's get to Strike's letter. He, again, starts with a date and starts with complimenting her quick thinking and offering a solution to the problem of her fake sister's address.
I love that he compliments her first thing. Because he knows she loves it when he tells her that she's amazing. He's seen her. React to compliments. Excellent note to start the letter on. A++, no notes.
All right. He tells her about his interview with the Graves family and that he hasn't had any luck finding Cherie, but tells her some good information that it seems like she had reason to want to hide.
Yeah, it must have been such a relief for her to have a solution for the address thing.
Totally. Anything that helps relieve some of that stress and worry is greatly appreciated, I'm sure.
I really love that he's sharing the info that he thinks is most relevant from his interviews, because that's the kind of stuff she needs to do her job better. If she knows Dio had an inheritance, then that's motive, and she has more context for her sleuthing, you know? Strike's being the best partner he can be. Even when they're separated like this, he's showing up for her and having her back on this job.
Next, he gives her a brief update on the Franks and the Little John situation.
He says that Wardle might know someone who could be a replacement. And we find out later that this falls through, right? I think we're definitely going to see another permanent hire soon.
Is anybody else super excited to see what kind of person we'll see have to be the sixth contractor? Because I know I for sure am.
I need to know. Who's it going to
be? Who's going to round out the agency? And then, of course, he ends the letter perfectly when he says, don't forget, the moment you've had enough, say the word and we'll come and get you out.
I particularly like that Strike phrases this as the moment you've had enough. It's not let us know when you have dirt good enough to get Will out. Strike is focusing solely on her own well-being here. He's reminding her that her exit is based on how she's doing, not on whether she's accomplished what she wants to do. And we know it's not like Robin's going to listen to this, of course. It's still nice that he's saying it. I also like his use of we here to remind her that she's got the whole agency backing her up.
You know, it's funny because going back to the Q&A and talking about Strike always putting the jobs before relationships, he's not doing that here. He's not putting the case first. He's putting Robin first.
He's putting Robin first. Oh my God. Oh my God. Okay.
I know.
It's the first time he's ever done that. Literally. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
We don't really get to see anything that she writes back to Murphy. I wish we had, because it would help us understand his responses. But I imagine that she wouldn't express her true feelings about his letter knowing Robin, which I do. Better than Murphy.
Yeah, I agree. I wish that we had gotten to read Robin's letters to Murphy, because I feel like it would have been interesting to see just how detached she is in these letters to him.
To Strike, she apologizes for not having more concrete information, which she really doesn't have to do. And then, of course, she says she wants to stay to get more. And then we know she thanked him for the chocolate.
So cute. And you know, he's just going to keep sending her chocolate.
Send her two.
I want them to have a little chocolate bowl in the office where he just fills it up for her.
It's ostensibly for prospective clients and people who come to the office, but really it's for
it's
Robin.
It's for Robin. All right, let's go to 42.
Yes, let's do it.
Hey,
all right.
42. I don't know about you. Feeling 42. That's going to be Strike's theme song in book 8.
Aww. Now I want to rewrite the lyrics to fit.
Same.
Everything will be all right if you say you love me too.
Oh, my God. Duh.
Sorry.
Okay. Oh.
Okay. In chapter 42, Robin discovers an important piece of physical evidence after dropping off her letters.
And the epigraph. 9 in the 5th place means a melon covered with willow leaves, hidden lines. The melon, like the fish, is a symbol of the principle of darkness. And that's from hexagram 44, coming to meet. I think what this is talking about are the pictures that are hidden in the barn. So it seems like the melon is representing the pictures, but I find it interesting that this is saying that the melon is the symbol of darkness, like the fish, because a symbol of a fish is like Mazu's fish pendant. It feels to me that symbols of darkness come from both Abigail and Mazu in this chapter. We see Abigail's cruelty through the photos, although we don't know that it's her yet. And we see Mazu's cruelty, I think, for the first time when she punishes these young girls.
Yes, you're totally right. That's such a good reading. This is that same hexagram for one of those Charlotte chapters about darkness coming unexpectedly from below and being represented by the feminine, by the woman, which 100% makes sense in terms of Mazu in this chapter. But I feel like maybe it should have been a hint that it was a woman who was behind the creation of these Polaroids as well. I mean, a girl. Actually, not even a woman yet. What interested me was that the judgment for this even says, pictured here in the image of a bold girl who lightly surrenders herself and thus seizes power. And I'm like, oh shit, yeah.
I love when there are clues and epigraphs. Mm-hmm. Of course, you kind of have to go digging in this one.
And it might be a complete reach.
Right.
But it's still fun. Probably didn't intend it, but it's still fun.
We start the chapter learning that there's some sort of search party happening. And remember, Robin's still out coming back from the rock. Yeah. And I don't think that I had much time to feel nervous about this because it says almost instantly that they were looking for a he. So I know she's still kind of at risk here, but I knew that this was going to be fine.
But what if they'd assigned Robin a spirit penis while she was gone? Huh? What then?
How could I forget? This is the only thing that this cult is missing is spirit penises. Spirit How could
penis.
I forget?
I feel like a cult's just not a cult without the concept of a spirit penis. That's the cult rules. Yeah. I don't make them. I just see them in Netflix documentaries. But if they had discovered Robin out of bed, would she have tried to brazen it out with some kind of excuse, like a story that justified her being up? Or would she have just booked it back to the clearing and escaped over the fence? Yeah, I ask like it's even a question. Of course she wouldn't have run.
No, I think she probably would have said that she got up to use the bathroom, heard the commotion, wanted to help or something.
Yeah, which is what she does, blend in with the crowd. Yeah.
And this is when she's able to push apart the wooden beams in the locked barn and then sneak in.
I would have never thought to look for weak wood to push them apart like this.
Yeah, me neither. It reminds me a bit of that scene, you know, from the TV version of Lethal White where they hide in the barn when Kinvara lets the dogs out after them.
So it was Kinvara who let them out this whole time.
We've solved it. We figured out who. Amazing. Who?
Let the dogs out.
Who? Kinvara Chisel. The doy.
Yep.
Oh, boy. Time. Anyway, this reminds me of when the room of requirement turns into the room with all the hidden things, you know, which should have told me that she was going to find something important.
Oh, wow. I hadn't even thought of that comparison, but yes, there's totally a similar vibe here. And I'm really happy that no one idiotically set this barn on fire while trapped inside with Robin at the climax of the novel, I gotta say, because I'd have been super worried that that was going to happen if I'd made that connection while I was reading. So I'm kind of glad I didn't.
It says that the pile of things is nearly as tall as Robin, and she concludes that they belong to people who have escaped.
That's a lot of people escaping if it's that tall.
Yeah, no kidding. Makes you wonder how many of those people are still alive or managed to live the rest of their lives, you know, naturally.
Do you guys notice the cuddly toy bunny in the pile with the cobwebs on its face? Because remember how Neve told the story about her little sister Maeve crying for the cuddly bunny that she'd taken to the farm, but that was locked up?
Yeah.
Because this is definitely the same bunny, right?
It has to be, yeah. I didn't notice that, but yeah, it must be.
Also, the comparison of the pile belongings to those inside old concentration camps is evocative, scary, and more than a little creepy.
It really was. And the picture of the pile of shoes that Robin mentions, everyone has seen that picture. Mm-hmm. We know exactly what picture she's talking about. It's one, definitely meant to instantly conjure that up in our mind. And it's meant to suggest to the reader that there is, yes, something very sinister going on here.
Here's where Robin finds the tin of Barnum's animals. Here we call them animal crackers, even though they're cookies. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but it's interesting to me that Robin feels a bit nostalgic about these and they remind her of the safety of her childhood home. But the image that we all know from these are these caged animals on the tins or packages. Mm-hmm. And I know this is probably a stretch. I don't know. There's something about caged, dangerous animals in Abigail. Like she too was caged and dangerous in the cult kind of thing. Probably a huge stretch.
She's also a bit of a ringleader if you want to keep up the circus metaphor.
Circus. Yeah, there we go. And you know what? It all ties back to the original strike who came in with the circus. I'm just kidding.
Oh, shit. You connected the dots. You connected them.
Just kidding.
Yeah, totally agree. Also kind of fits with Robin, doesn't it? Because right now she's caged. She is very dangerous if you're the wrong kind of person.
It says something was pulling Robin to this tin and urging her to look inside. She finally realizes that it's because of the ban on any sugar that's making this tin so out of place.
Something I want to pay attention to is if there are any differences in the way the books describe Strike having hunches versus Robin having them. Mm. I'd really have to do a whole reread of the series with this in mind or go looking for it. But I don't know, maybe Robin is more open to hunches and then finds the reason for them. I'm not sure, but it was interesting to read how she has this hunch and then she comes to understand why she's feeling that way.
I'd love to do that and see what we come up with, the whole reread on hunches. I'm comparing this moment when Robin's subconscious is telling her something and she takes a minute to figure out why with the moment later on when Robin's subconscious tells her something and she doesn't question it at all. She knows and accepts it without a moment's hesitation or questioning. She doesn't need to know why. She just knows.
I'd love for Strike to have a moment like this one in an upcoming book.
His own moment of knowing.
But anyway, Robin opens it and finds the Polaroids, even though she doesn't look at them yet, and then runs back out to join the crowd where they've now found the missing toddler.
The whole rest of the chapter is really disturbing to me because we get these two teenage girls who we see begging Mazu not to punish them for the toddler's escape. Tayo grabbing them and carrying them away. Their screams later on.
It's horrifying. Mazu, Tayo, all of them. Just monsters.
This is the first time we're witnessing the real fear and horror here. Not just the underfeeding and exhaustion and indoctrination and emotional abuse, but the actual physical torture that we've been told the UHC uses for punishment, but which Robin hasn't yet witnessed. But now she knows for sure that this is happening. She's not going to stop until she proves it.
Also, just as a mother, I was horrified by the toddler trying to hold on to Louise for comfort and being taken from her. There's just something so viscerally upsetting about little babies not given comfort or taken away from the person who's comforting them.
Yeah, that was definitely really hard to read. You know, the entire time I was reading these parts for the first time, those kind of parts would automatically make me think of you, Lindsay, because you're the mom that I know. So, I mean, this is hard to read, period, but I can't imagine how much more difficult
the one mom,
it is.
You know one mom.
I know one mom.
It's kind of like the way all the fart parts make us think of pools automatically because she hates it so much.
I don't like that association at all.
It's not our fault. Other people have said it too. I automatically think of her.
Thanks. I hate that. I want to immediately stop thinking of me. I don't
get to help it.
Well, control your brains, people.
You've made it a thing.
I hate that. Okay.
It's part of your brand now.
That's not my brand. I need a brand manager to wipe this out of my brand.
Hating farts is part of your brand. You just have to embrace it.
Going back to Louise having the baby ripped away from her. Do you know what I wondered as I was reading this? I wondered why it was that we never hear of Louise having had any other children at the farm other than Jacob, which was pretty recent. Because she was young when she joined. She was a spirit wife. Is it possible that maybe in those first few years at the cult, she had another child or children and Kevin was just too young to remember and mention it? I just wondered because, I don't know, Bo clinging to her and then Mazu forcing them apart. It felt a bit like Jing clinging to Will, you know? And I know that it wouldn't be possible for Bo to be her child, but could he be her grandchild? Because if she'd had a baby in those first couple of years at the cult that we never found out about because Kevin was too young to know and Beck and Emily couldn't talk about it because flesh objects.
Yeah, could be totally possible.
No, that's a bit of a tinfoil theory, but...
When has that ever stopped you?
Never. Literally never.
And then, of course, there are the Polaroids themselves.
I gotta say, amateur pornography was not the turn I expected this case to take when I was reading it for the first time. The pig masks are really a nice touch.
Oh, you know what I realized? They found amateur pornography, well, you know, a horrific snuff film, in Troubled Blood, too, in the course of an investigation.
Oh, maybe we should have seen it coming.
We should have. Mm-hmm. And in Troubled Blood, they thought they'd found their victim, but they hadn't. Though it did help them solve a different murder. Here, they seem to think that the Polaroids might be incriminating to the church in some way, but they don't realize that the literal murderer is in the photos and orchestrating the whole thing until the very end, right?
Yeah, that's a great parallel. Yeah. And Ricci was taking the video, wasn't he? He was just out of frame sometimes, the way Abigail's kind of orchestrating everything.
Yeah, I feel like Ricci, I feel like he was taking it because we see his, like, list line.
His ring.
Yeah.
Okay, should we go to 43?
Okay, so in chapter 43, news of Strike's affair with Bijou makes its way into an issue of Private Eye.
The epigraph for this chapter reads, six in the fourth place means entangled folly brings humiliation. And that's hexagram four, youthful folly.
I feel like this one's a really easy one to interpret. Strike's stupidest entanglement is about to bring him humiliation.
Nailed it. I'm laughing that this hexagram is entitled Youthful Folly because the man's 41 years old and still out here being an idiot. Youthful folly is not reserved solely for the young, apparently.
So starting out this chapter, we're back with Strike and he's having a meeting in the basement of the Flying Horse.
Was I the only one who noticed the name change here? So we were wondering when the books were going to talk about the Tottenham being renamed the Flying Horse, and here it is.
Here it is. Finally, I am super excited about this change because, now this is just a teaser, I'm not going to spoil an upcoming episode, but when we look at a certain epigraph later in the book, and then we think about how this book ends, there's something really exciting about the pub's new name. And I'm really excited to get there when we get there, because I think it's important.
Intriguing.
It just remains to be a joy to me when real life is woven into the books. I really love it.
It's so fun. With all these changes going on around Denmark Street and the locations around the office, I know we've all been wondering in the past, are they going to keep calling it the Tottenham? Are they going to follow what happens in real life? And it was really nice and kind of neat to see that change. Though it does make you wonder what's going to end up happening to the office, though. If they're going to divert from reality or if they're actually going to have to change where the office is.
I still don't think they're going to divert from reality. I think they're going to end up leaving. But I think that from what I've found, I think we've talked about this before, that they still have a little bit of time left. I think 2017 was the date that I found was when people really, really had to leave. So we'll see.
Oh, is that what the May 2017 ticket stub could mean? Their last trip from the Tottenham office.
Yeah.
Was it going to Tottenham Court Station or away from Tottenham?
I don't remember. But that's something.
But I had been curious about what Strike would think of the name change, just because sometimes I don't like change and something like this might unsettle me a little bit. Maybe that sounds weird.
No, that's normal. If it was me, I would 100% just keep calling it the Tottenham, just like I will keep calling that one app Twitter.
It says, as an Arsenal fan, Strike thoroughly approved of the rebrand. And I don't really understand what being an Arsenal fan has to do with him liking the new name.
I also had to look this up because I had no idea. As I understand it, he's actually just happy that it's not the Tottenham anymore because the Tottenham Spurs and Arsenal are ancient football rivals, or so Google and Reddit have informed me.
Okay.
So yeah.
I did not have the context for that. I was thinking that it had something to do with the Flying Horse name. So it could have been anything. It's just not the Tottenham. I was trying to figure out what their mascot was. I was like, is it a flying horse? Why?
That'd be a cool mascot. Mm-hmm. I use a big fan of the animated Hercules of Pegasus.
Oh yeah.
As we all are.
Yeah, as we all are. But I laughed when I looked this up because we know that Nick is a Spurs fan. I didn't realize it before, but Strike and Nick are basically the Romeo and Juliet of football fans.
It's a forbidden friendship.
Yeah.
It would be so much fun to see them go to a game together where their teams are playing each other.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Would they sit together and just be decked out?
Robin and Ilse are there just rolling their eyes. It would be great. Also, it's hilarious that he's doing the meeting here just so that Little John won't turn up accidentally.
Cool kids only at this meeting. No Little John's allowed.
It's understandable, though, to not want the man who might be a spy and will soon be fired to not hear your business.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense. I felt a little awkward nervousness when he called in just a little bit, like somehow he was going to know that they're all together without him.
Oh my God, I would feel so awkward too. I'd be sitting there sipping my beer like,
Yeah.
So in the meeting, we find out from Barclay, who has apparently been doing some very good investigating on his own initiative, that the Franks have priors for stalking and flashing, that they receive suspended sentences, and that they're using fake names. I just really identified with Midge's reaction here. Just typical. Absolutely typical. Her frustration and anger is super justified here. And I get the sense that it's part of why she left the police. Being unable to take real action, you know, all the red tape and having to follow shitty orders and stand by when awful men get off scot-free. Like, what bullshit?
You know what I'm kind of interested in is they're all talking about the Bigfoot case and agree that Dev will go inside this building as a safety inspector or something to get photos of him cheating. But Strike says that they'll get him fake documentation, like an ID, that kind of thing. How do they get that stuff?
I don't know. That's a good question. Because we never hear of a contact who does stuff like that. Maybe Spanner would be able to do it. Maybe Shanker could have contacts. Or maybe Pat has a shady past as a forger.
She does have a lot of secrets.
So many secrets. So many skills.
We never hear about how they go about this or if it's legal. I'm really curious about it. Because, you know, Strike and Robin have pushed boundaries in Lethal Whites with bugging. But I don't think they'd do something too far that would potentially jeopardize the agency or mean that their evidence wouldn't stand in court.
Yeah, that's a good question. In the US, I feel like a legal team would argue that any evidence that's obtained by dodgy or criminal means is fruit of the poisonous tree and inadmissible in court. But after a quick Google search, though, it looks like that principle is actually exclusive to U.S. law, which is something I didn't actually know.
I didn't know that either, but I did know that phrase because I saw it in an episode of The Rookie.
Of course you did.
So I knew that. I felt so smart when you said that. I'm like, I know what the fruit of the poisonous tree is.
The whole thing really interests me, though, because I know that we have very different laws sometimes surrounding private investigation, because I know that one of the biggest things that I was told that we were not allowed to do was say that we were someone we weren't.
Oh.
So that kind of throws out everything that, you know, Robin does when she's undercover.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's a law in the UK.
Apparently not.
You know, I was reading an explanation of this online that included a bit from it's Article 6 of the European Convention of Human Rights. It's supposed to be kind of similar to how they do it in the UK. And I found it really interesting. It says, it is not the role of the court to determine as a matter of principle whether particular types of evidence, for example, unlawfully obtained evidence, may be admissible or, indeed, whether the applicant was guilty or not. The question which must be answered is whether the proceedings as a whole, including the way in which the evidence was obtained, were fair. If any of our UK listeners work in law, it would be interesting to hear your perspective.
And in this specific case, the documents wouldn't be used to actually gain entry since it's just a hotel that anyone can walk into. They'd just be an excuse if randos got suspicious about you loitering around. So I feel like it wouldn't really be relevant in this specific case.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think they'd be breaking the law here by going in. I'm just curious about the documents and where making them falls on that line.
Yeah.
But anyway, we learn that it's Strike's turn to go to the Rock, and it made my heart ache a little bit. And I had wondered if he was going to wait at the gate for her or something.
Oh my God, my heart. I bet he was very tempted to just sit there all night and wait for her. I kind of wonder why he didn't. I guess he just didn't want to risk it. But how romantic would that have been? Stuck on opposite sides of the wall, so happy to see and hear each other, so sad that it was only for a moment. Maybe they could have touched hands through the barbed wire.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Said, I miss you.
I guess it would have taken away the full separation and then reuniting moment.
Yeah, I know.
So Midge makes the very helpful to the reader comment that Robin has been at Chapman Farm for a month now. And I remember thinking, wow, it's been a month already.
Yeah. And now we're rereading and we're like, oh my God, it's only a quarter of the way through. I can't handle another 3 months of this.
The only way we and Robin could get through it the first time was not knowing how long it was going to be.
Yeah.
I say that as if I wouldn't have devoured it in the same amount of time.
Yeah, of course.
Strike's response that Robin wants to stay because, you know, Robin, no half measures.
They do know Robin, and Strike knows Robin. You know who doesn't know Robin?
I do.
Sipping my tea? I think we all know.
I notice it's a very casual response. He doesn't touch on any emotion or worries, but I imagine his true feelings here are a mixture of missing her and worry, but also probably a little bit of pride at her dedication and drive for the thing that they've built together.
Yeah.
I know that's a lot to take away from one little throwaway comment, but...
No, it's good. It's good. I think it's time for an emergency emotions closet deployment, because every time I think about how these two have built this business from the ground up and fought tooth and nail for its survival together. I just want to cry. Okay, so let's get to the juicy bits, because once the meeting is over, Dev asks to have a private word with Strike, and this is when he shows him the article in Private Eye. And I gotta say, Dev is a real one for bringing this up.
He seriously is. Dev does not shy away from awkward conversations or confrontations, does he? He is the MVP for having Strike's back like this and letting him know about it.
Yeah, if there's anything that will really win me over, it's having Strike's back like this.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to take back what I said before, that I don't think I know much about him, because you're so right. Maybe we don't know a lot of details, but what we do know, I really, really like.
Yeah.
He's a good guy with some sort of interesting story there.
Yeah, there's deep oceans in there.
All right, and then Strike reads the article about Andrew Honeybadger Humboldt QC.
I want to know why he's called Honeybadger.
Well, I mean, honeybadgers are known for being like fearless and honestly just fucking ruthless. So I would imagine that would be a nickname for his approach to, you know, the courtroom and professionally speaking.
A honeybadger don't care. A honeybadger don't give a shit. It just takes what it wants. Mm-hmm.
Hell yes, yeah.
Yes, Honey Badger.
I guess this is some weird internet thing, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah, of course
yes,
it is.
Yes, it is. Of course it is.
It's an internet classic.
The article says that a mole told the journalist that Bijou had been telling everyone about her affair. I am a little unclear about this. I think it might be implied that she's the one who did this, but it just doesn't make sense to me, because why on earth would she think telling a journalist that she was bugging this man's office make her think that he'd then leave his wife for her? Is it possible that she was gossiping all over the workplace, hoping it would get back to Honbold, and someone else overheard and told the journalist?
Yeah, based on what's said here, that's, I think, what's happened here, or implied to be happening, because she was absolutely talking constantly about both her affair with Honbold and sleeping with Strike. As we know from Ilsa, she must have just accidentally told the wrong person who gave the tip off to Private Eye about it.
Because I had said before that I think she was wanting publicity to get Honbold jealous.
Mm-hmm.
That can't be right, because maybe she was just hoping that the gossip within the office would get back to him.
I think that was her plan. Gossip enough so that Honbold hears rumors and gets jealous enough to leave his wife and lock Bijou down, which is a stupid ass plan. But, you know, I don't think Bijou's exactly the sharpest knife in the drawer. So maybe it made sense to her.
The journalist is reporting that Bijou is having an affair with Honbold, obviously threatening his 25-year marriage, and that her connection with Strike is not only sexual, but that he's helping her bug his office. Do I have all that right?
Yeah, you do. I think that the insinuation the piece is making is that Bijou might be trying to make secret recordings of her affair with Honbold to, I don't know, pressure him into leaving his wife or sell to the paper.
Blackmail
who
him.
Who knows? Blackmail him. Yeah.
Terrible plan. Mm-hmm. Anyway, not good. Not good for Strike. Not good for the agency.
Not good at all.
This next bit is really great. He'd had enough experience of both kinds of misfortune to know that there was a vast difference between feeling yourself a victim of random strokes of fate and having to accept that your troubles have been brought about by your own folly. He'd been warned by Ilsa that Bijou was mouthy and indiscreet, and what had he done? Fucked her a second time. After avoiding the spotlight for years, giving testimony in court cases only in a full beard, refusing every offer of a press interview, and ending a previous relationship with a woman who'd wanted him to pose with her at high-profile events, he'd knowingly bedded a loudmouth with, it turned out, a well-known married lover in the background.
Reading this made me really happy, because he's actually taking the blame.
Yeah, he knows he done fucked up.
And I don't think that anyone would expect someone to act like Bijou is acting. But he does have to take responsibility. And we get a vow from this later. So I was really happy with this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now that is some growth, baby. We love to see some self-awareness and accountability.
It's kind of interesting because the consequences of his bad choice with Madeline was personal, a very personal rock bottom. This is now crossing the line to professional. And I think in a lot of ways that could be more eye-opening for some people, especially for a man who kept so much of his personal life to himself. He was able to suffer with Madeline alone. He can't do that now. And it's a good thing for him because it's kind of forcing him to face what his bad decisions are costing him.
Mm-hmm.
I have a troubled blood parallel for you, though, with this phone call that he makes to Ilsa, because in these two apology calls, he makes troubled blood to Robin and now to Ilsa, he says the same thing, calling to apologize.
Oh, he does.
And of course, this apology to Ilsa didn't make me want to cry with relief and make me feel all warm and fuzzy, but that's okay. It's still really good.
It is really good. And He is only partly calling to apologize because he actually needs Ilsa to tell him where Bijou is. But you know what? It still counts. And I'm glad because Ilsa deserved an apology. If he just listened to her long enough to get to the bit about the condom theft, this would never have happened.
Yeah, she did deserve it. And I hope she goes and tells Nick a big fat I told you so too.
100%.
This is another long shot, but he tells Ilsa that you've been proven right in spades. And one thing that I think about probably way too much is what Ilsa's reaction is going to be when Strike and Robin get together and are officially a couple. I feel like there could be something like this. Mm-hmm. Her saying she was right, or one of them saying, okay, fine, you were right. You know, I'm just putting this down as a potential future parallel.
I cannot wait until the captain of our ship receives her vindication and an acknowledgement of all of her hard work on behalf of these two dummies. She has worked herself to the bone, completely selflessly, for their happiness, and she's received no thanks. I, for one, salute you, Ilsa. You've done a great job here.
And we end the chapter knowing that Strike is headed right now to confront her. And you know what? I know that Strike screwed up here, but I was excited about this because this woman is terrible. She needs to come to Jesus talk real quick.
And I'm excited to get to it because the result of this conversation is well worth the other stuff.
Yeah, it is. And I always love Strike going gloves off and putting the fear of God into people. It's just big detective energy, you know? It's good to see. I like it.
Okay, should we go to 44?
44.
In this chapter, Strike meets with Bijou about the story about them in the press. And then for the epigraph for this chapter, it says, "A man must part company with the inferior and superficial. The important thing is to remain firm." And that is from Hexagram 17, following.
This is another one that's pretty straightforward. Strike is firmly parting company with Bijou, who is inferior and superficial and a whole lot of other things.
So many things. You know, like, good for him.
And for me, this epigraph, very clearly referring to Bijou in that way, tells me that Strike is in the right at this point of the Bijou issue.
Yeah.
As I've said, he has responsibility here, but that does not minimize the bad behavior on Bijou's part.
Absolutely. It's interesting to me that this hexagram is concerned with how to acquire a following. That is, how to be the superior man that other people are willing to follow. Because we've just seen Dev give Strike a heads up with this, because Strike has surrounded himself with a team of good people. But his behavior here has put the team at risk, and he's risked losing some of that respect too, because he can tell that Dev thinks he's been an idiot, and he's glad that Robin isn't witnessing his fuck up. And it's just this quote from the hexagram says, if he throws himself away on unworthy friends, he loses connection with people of intellectual power who could further him in the good.
Wasn't that the epigraph for when he fights with Robin and Ilsa in the office?
Was that? Yeah, that feels familiar, doesn't it? Hang on, what chapter was that in?
I think it's the same epigraph, which, I mean, it's all about Bijou.
Yeah, she's, well, very inferior. That same, it's a different, slightly different part of that hexagram, but it's making the same point. You can't be with both inferior and superior people. You got to pick one.
I'm really glad that we didn't have to go through another cult chapter before we got to this confrontation with Bijou, because I was really ready for it.
Oh, yeah. It says, this, Strike thought, was the first time he had been glad that Robin was currently at Chapman Farm. He'd done something bloody stupid, and while the consequences were likely to be more severe for himself than the agency as a whole, he preferred Robin to remain in ignorance of the mess he'd got himself into. Which is funny, because she ends up finding out anyway.
But it's different. It's different to find out after the fact than during.
The disaster, yeah.
I mean, I kind of shared this feeling with Strike, because we know that I thought that her feelings about the Ross case in Ink Black Heart were a little unfair. Not that I think for a second that he would actually choose to trade Robin being mad at him for her being stuck away in some cult, but...
Yeah, he'd rather have an angry Robin.
Oh,
I think he'd also just, he'd feel embarrassed about her knowing that he's been such an idiot. Not necessarily just anger, but just her knowing. And maybe silently raising an eyebrow at him in her mind would be enough to make him cringe with that sort of, oh, why did I do that? He wouldn't want her to think less of him.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And Robin is in a different place than she was in Ink Blackheart. So I think she might be upset on his behalf that Bijou did this while also complaining with Ilsa about how dumb he is being, which is a fair place to be, because I think that's where I am.
Yeah.
While Strike is waiting to confront Bijou, we get a quick call from Shanker that he's all set for an interview with Jordan Rini.
You know what's so funny about this? I'm going to blame my stress level while reading the book for the first time. But when Shanker says that there will be security there to make sure Reedy's cooperating, why did I think he meant like a guard?
Oh my God, that is too funny.
You know, you're just too law-abiding, Lindsay. You don't have the criminal mindset. You just don't have the criminal brain.
I was just thinking, well, that's nice of Shanker to set up some security guard for Strike. How thoughtful.
So thoughtful. Wow.
Oh, nice of them. Anyway, the rest of this chapter is pretty quick. He spots her and then he follows her.
Yeah, by the way, she's wearing all red, a bright red coat and a tight red dress, which one probably makes her easy to follow. But I don't know, it's a very loud outfit, which suits her. Makes me think of Scandal a bit. She's like Carmen Sandiego trying to follow her.
Carmen Sandiego. This made me think of all the different colors that they make the members wear in the UHC. Because doesn't Robin have to switch over to a red tracksuit in this set of chapters?
Mm-hmm.
Red is for the Stolen Prophet, Graves. And then I was like, maybe that's the connection to Charlotte's sudden colors. Gold for the Golden Prophet. Red for the Stolen One. And I'm like, no, I think this is actually nothing. I'm just grasping at straws. I think you're right, and that this is just a bright, attention-grabbing, scandalous outfit. And a big red flashing danger sign.
Either of you guys think it was odd that he wanted to go sit down inside a pub and talk to her? Because I felt like I would have just said it right on the street and walked away.
I think that it would have been to make sure that she wasn't being watched by a journalist or something. Like if he saw someone follow them in off the street, then he'd have known that they might be overheard. So he's controlling the environment, right? He's making sure it's private enough to say what he needs to say.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think that was it.
I was still a little bit confused about whether or not it was Bijou who talked to the journalist, but her crying does tell me that she genuinely believed that this man was going to leave his wife for her. And now he wants nothing to do with her for telling everyone about his infidelity. And so she's sad, I guess.
Yeah.
She didn't get her way, or she has feelings for Hanbold.
This is her plan backfiring because she's getting too much attention. And now Hanbold's wife has been tipped off via the news. So there's no chance of a quiet divorce where their affair isn't uncovered, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this was her plan. This isn't what she wanted exactly.
I don't believe her when she tells Strike that she liked him.
Mm-hmm. Which is insane. Like, who doesn't like Strike? But I don't think Bijou did. Yeah.
I agree with Strike's assessment that she was just using him to try and make Hanbold jealous.
Also, liking his dick doesn't count as liking him as a person, Bijou.
Okay.
No, you gotta like his arms, his back, and curly hair as well.
All of it. All of it.
The whole pouch.
We like all of it. For the record, I don't think Strike cares in the slightest about being used.
No.
I think he's taking offense at her trying to insult his intelligence now that he's caught on and all of this has exploded.
I agree.
What are your opinions on Strike threatening to dig up dirt on her if she doesn't deny all of this is true? Because I feel like it can be a little jarring to see him really mad like this, but this was almost laughable to me that Bijou sits here acting shocked that he's threatening her when she's doing the exact same thing to him by spreading lies that he's done something illegal. Mm-hmm. He's pretty much just threatening to do the exact same thing to her that she's just done to him. So I feel like she can get right off that high horse and stop playing the victim.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. You know, she played a stupid game and she was going to win a stupid prize.
Literal definition of fuck around and find out.
He left the ship feeling no qualms whatsoever about the tactics he'd just employed, but consumed with fury at her and himself. Time would tell whether he was going to find the mail at his own door, but as he walked back towards Holborn Tube Station, he vowed to himself that this would be the last time, ever, he risked his own privacy or career for a pointless affair undertaken to distract him from thoughts of Robin Ellicott.
You know, he said time would tell at the end as well, didn't he?
I was just thinking that. Yes, he did.
You know what I just thought? So we've got this plot with the male trying to dig up dirt on him and write a profile. And then at the end of this novel, we've got Dominic Culpepper coming back into the scene. What was that? So the cricketer thought that his ex-wife was sleeping with Dominic Culpepper, who's married to Lady Violet. So we've got the tabloid journalist coming in as part of their investigation. I'm wondering if part of Book 8's plot is going to be the mail publishing that story on Strike. It's totally made up and maybe it causing some conflict.
I'm assuming, though, that we all had the same reaction just to scream. To he bit. Vowed it.
Yes.
Vowed.
Oh my God.
Vow.
When I tell you, I screamed the biggest scream I have ever scrumped, ever. I cannot believe he fucking vowed it.
Vowed
that is huge.
It. You know, his whole thing with vows makes me even more certain that one day he and Robin are going to get married because he's going to make his wedding vows the ultimate Strike vow.
Well, you know, I'm with you. Yeah.
100%.
Because she could have used any word. promise, yeah. commitment, pact, oath. She could have used anything. He makes vows.
And he keeps them.
I also think it's important that he's acknowledging that he's been doing this as a distraction from his feelings for Robin. I think, along with other things, that this helps nudge him in the right direction of telling Robin how he feels. I'm really looking forward to Robin realizing that she's kind of doing the same things.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be so much fun to read. Mm-hmm. Also, hey, Joe, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Can we get a hint on book 8? Please. Thank you.
I feel like we were learning this time last year, the release date.
I feel like we were.
It is a really big deal, though. We had hoped for this change after Madeline, which is why Bijou was so upsetting to me in the first place. But this vow promises a change in behavior for book 8.
Oh, yeah. It absolutely is a huge deal because we all know from reading chapter 24 of Lethal White that he makes few vows because he trusts himself to keep them. So the fact that he is vowing to refrain from any more affairs to distract from his feelings for Robin is incredible.
I guess there's a chance that he could start a new relationship as if he's trying to move on, but that feels too much like what he was doing with Madeline. My prediction is that book 8 will be the second book, Troubled Blood being the first, where we have a single and celibate strike. I think that might be the case until Robin.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you there. I feel like the only amorous pairings with Strike going forward are going to be with himself and his right hand.
Oh, God, Ken.
I can only hope that you two are right. The specific wording of this vow, that he'd never again risk his own privacy or career for a pointless affair, I feel like it does sort of leave that wiggle room for a real relationship that isn't a risk to those things. But on the other hand, isn't a relationship with any woman other than Robin a completely pointless affair for him?
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree. I feel like the next woman that Strike sleeps with and the last one that he's going to sleep with is going to be Robin.
If we were at book 4,
yeah,
maybe, but I don't think there's any going back now that he's told her. Okay, let's go to chapter 45.
Yes. All right. In chapter 45, Robin speaks with Penny Brown.
And the epigraph, but every relationship between individuals bears within it the danger that wrong turns may be taken. And that's hexagram 54, the marrying maiden. So this is the chapter where Robin tries to confide in Penny, the teenager with the green hair, in order to try and get some information, but it backfires when Penny is offended and ends up telling Mazu. So
yeah,
I think that's what it's talking about.
I think this is the first time that we've gotten this specific hexagram.
Yeah, I don't remember the marrying maiden ever.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it is about young girls who get married. And I think it's very much framing Penny's entrance into this cult as a twisted, destructive kind of marriage to Wace and his principles, right? In which she's completely lost as her own person. One of the line judgments says this: a girl who's taken into the family, but not as the chief wife, must behave with special caution and reserve. She must not take it upon herself to supplant the mistress of the house. And isn't that just what Penny is doing here? Behaving with caution, reserve, not supplanting Mazu, but to the extent that she's terrified of offending the chief wife. So much so that she hides in the shower stall and then goes to tattle on Robin, because this is a very dark, yeah, horrifying place for this young maiden to be.
All right, so we start the chapter hearing that Robin had to carry those Polaroids around in her bra for a whole week until she was able to put them in the rock.
It must have been so stressful for her, worried that they would fall out. Imagine if they had. How do you explain having those pictures on you?
Oh, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's the box.
Pools, are you happy with this next bit that says they're all given red track suits instead of the orange? Is red better for you?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the shade, but yeah, I'd be happier with red.
I'd be happier with red, but it wouldn't be my favorite.
Yeah, I'd be counting down the days until the switch to blue.
Blue? Yeah, me too.
I wouldn't actually be counting them down because the whole I don't have a calendar thing. But, yeah, you know, the sentiment would be there.
Vivian explains that the color changes because they're now entering the season of the stolen prophet.
Such a know-it-all. Calm down, girl. Anyone can read the answer.
Pools, you were talking before about each color that was associated with each prophet. What are they?
Orange is wounded, red is stolen, white is drowned, and blue is healer. We don't know about golden, but I'm going to go ahead and guess that it's yellow.
It's a good guess.
Yeah, which makes basically the whole year a nightmare with anyone cool undertones to their skin. No thanks. The only season I can wear is the pedophile doctor's season. No, thank you.
Thanks. I hate it.
It's probably the worst thing about the cult.
I think it might be up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is when Robin and Penny get the box of hair color remover with a quotation from the answer that says, "The false self craves that which is artificial and unnatural."
I want to bring us back to that theory we mentioned when we discussed the color blue, because obviously, we are now at the chapter where she removes the blue from her hair. And if the theory is correct, removing that connection with Strike, and the very next chapter is when she starts pretending to talk to Strike in her head.
Oh, I had forgotten about that connection. That is so good. She's got a blue in her head that they can't take away.
Oh, I love that so much. That quote about the false self is so ridiculous, because feels to me like brand new Mercedes are pretty artificial and unnatural waste.
He grows them at his Mercedes farm.
His Mercedes farm. You know what else is artificial and unnatural? Indoor plumbing, the internet. But funnily enough, my true self really loves both of those things. So I don't think that his book is correct.
Making a controversial statement there.
So controversial. It's so brave. That's me.
I think that people are going to be arguing with you on Twitter about this one.
I know. But you know what? That's what I do. I speak harsh truths. I think waste is full of shit. There you go. I said it. Come at me.
I can see why Robin thought that Penny would be a good person to try and attempt to get some negative thoughts out of, because she's only been there as long as Robin, so she might not be as afraid yet.
Plus, she's quite young and maybe a bit naive. She seems a bit easy to manipulate into the conversation you want her to have.
Well, she's also really willing to talk.
And yeah.
She starts out gossiping that Louise has had her head shaved for about a year at this point.
And, you know, I think her talking and then her sadness about having to lose the green hair, I think that makes Robin a bit more confident in her not being fully indoctrinated than maybe she should have been.
She also tells Robin all about her time with Jacob, which is good information for Robin.
Good information. And she's Robin is so skillful in her fishing for information here. Really delicately and well done. Also, the fact that we learn that Zhao calls the NHS the Nazi hate squad is very silly. Absolutely ridiculous. But Penny saying that they euthanize people like Jacob out there, girl, they are literally starving him to death in here.
Why do you think they let Penny take care of him?
I think she's not the brightest crayon in the box. She's sweet, but she doesn't have the kind of strength of mind or character that would make her a threat to them, knowing what they're doing to Jacob, right? She's malleable and she's gullible, so she's fine to take care of Jacob because she's just going to believe whatever they tell her. She's not going to make a break for it and call the cops.
It's the exact opposite of why they let Robin take care of him.
Yeah, they know full well that she is going to be made complicit.
Which is weird to me. That's a weird argument, because being forced to commit a crime under duress is a real thing. It's a real defense. Right? I don't understand why they think that Robin would be held accountable for what they did to Jacob just because she helped take care of him.
And they really underestimated her escape abilities too.
Yeah.
They fucked up there.
Anyway, the second Robin implies that Mazu must dye her hair black, Penny is offended and then storms off to the showers.
Obviously, she dyes her hair.
Yeah.
I think the thing that might have upset Penny here is that Robin's statement is proving a contradiction in the church.
Oh, yeah. She's doing the equivalent of sticking her fingers in her ears and going, la, 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 la.
Yeah. But it's so funny that she's sitting here gossiping about everybody. And then the second Robin says one thing about Mazu's hair.
Yeah.
With anything to avoid that cognitive dissonance.
I think she'd be terrified in the specific about being standing near a person who had just insulted Mazu or questioned Mazu. Dyeing your hair is not an insult. But in case the punishment comes down on her as well, she's terrified of Mazu. Everyone is. So that's why she's so scared and she books it off and then tells on her to Mazu to protect herself, I guess.
I wonder how that happened. If she went straight to Mazu or if she told somebody else, maybe she told Becca or maybe she told Jang.
Yeah, because I wouldn't want to talk to Mazu.
No.
About anything.
No.
Ever.
No.
You don't even want to get too close to her because then you'd have to smell her.
Ugh.
Well, that was fun.
Those were some fun chapters.
It was fun just ripping apart Ryan Murphy.
They were. We're getting to some good stuff now in the book.
All right. What are we doing next time, Kenz?
All right. We are doing chapters 46 through 49. And in those chapters, we see Robin starting to struggle with the church's indoctrination. And then we see Strike receiving two kind of alarming phone calls, one from Tasha Mayo and another from Charlotte.
Oh, I'm really excited about that one.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.